turn around, but I saw his shoulders begin to shake. When he turned, he too was trying not to laugh. You're an idiot, you know that? That seems to be the consensus this weekend. He put down the broken cue. Sorry, he said. I'll buy a new one. I do it all the time, I said, then pretended to be unable to break a cue over my knee. Ernie laughed more and sat on a bar stool. I set my stick down on the table. What happened? I asked. He took another moment to compose himself. I went to pick her up, and her dad met me at the door. I put out my hand to greet him, and he stared at it like it had shit on it. Then he said, My daughter does not date jungle bunnies. He didn't, Mickey said, getting off her bar stool. That cocksucker. Then he told me to get my black ass off his porch before he called the police and had me arrested for trespassing. Son of a bitch, Mickey said. Let's go egg his fucking house. Don't get me wrong. Burlingame wasn't Mississippi in the 1960s. People weren't wearing hooded robes and burning crosses on lawns. But that was not to say racism didn't exist. Ernie had been taunted with the N-word on the football field and during basketball games. Once, as a child, he was accused of stealing in a store because the store owner believed that's what colored people did. As we got older, Ernie and I both realized one of the reasons we spent so much time together was because we were the two kids in class most frequently discriminated against. The racism was hidden in high school because of Ernie's athletic exploits, but only to an extent. At dances and parties, there was never a shortage of girls who wanted to dance and flirt with the great Ernie Cantwell. But I'd also started noticing a pattern, perhaps because I was all too familiar with it myself. If the girls were white, and most in Burlingame were, Ernie's flirtations rarely progressed beyond the flirting. It was one thing to be friendly to a black kid. It was quite another to have him show up at your house to meet your parents and take you on a date. Girls made excuses not to give Ernie their phone numbers. Those who did usually met him someplace rather than have him come to their home. And those who did go out on a date with him usually had excuses why they couldn't go out with him a second time. Let it go, I said to Ernie. Though it was Mickey who responded. Mickey never let anything go. What? How can you say let it go? The guy is a racist asshole, and his daughter is a stupid bitch for not knowing better. He's ignorant, I said. He's an ignorant, racist, asshole cocksucker, just like you said, which means he would be too stupid to understand why we egged his house, even if we did. In his mind, it would only justify his belief system. Fuck that! You can't change people's irrational beliefs, Mickey. Trust me. I know. I looked at Ernie. So does Ernie. Ernie glanced at me and nodded. And that guy? He's not the guy you have to worry about. The ones to worry about are the ones who cloak their discrimination behind some other excuse so you can't call them out. Unfortunately, as our senior year in high school was coming to an end, Ernie and I would have to experience those people yet again. 7. Each year, the St. Joe's Trustees, a group composed of parents, alumni, and prominent community members, chose the class valedictorian from a field of the top 10 candidates. As far back as anyone could remember, the honor always went to the student who finished number one in his class, and that student in the graduating class of 1975 was me. So, while Ernie, the greatest athlete the school had ever produced, was on the shortlist, he had already conceded defeat and spent much of the week leading up to the announcement pumping me up. I'd tried not to get my hopes up, but I had to admit that I'd also considered the announcement scheduled for a Friday afternoon a formality. In fact, I'd already begun to draft my speech, intended it to be the best valedictorian speech ever given. It had to be. This was another opportunity to prove myself, much the same way I saw my chance to be lector at OLM as a chance to show that I was just a normal kid. I could only hope being valedictorian had a better ending. I found the draft of my speech inside my mother's scrapbook labeled 1975. I never did write a final version. Friday afternoon, during my free period, I was laying out the last edition of The Friar in the journalism room, a portable trailer located at the back of the junior class parking lot with no hookup to the school PA system. When the bell rang, I hurried across the parking lot into the main school for my physics class, but found the main hall crowded with students hooting and hollering, and quickly realized I'd missed something important. "What's going on?" I asked the first student I saw. "They announced class valedictorian," he confirmed. "Didn't you hear?" Obviously, I hadn't, and I was wondering why the kid hadn't congratulated me. Everybody in school knew, at the very least, who I was. In fact, no one passing in the hallway stopped to congratulate me. At that moment, a group of students spilled out of one of the classrooms into the hall, Ernie in the middle of the pack, receiving pats on the back and congratulations. In a novel, this would be the place where I told you that Ernie and I made eye contact, or that I graciously marched up and congratulated him. But I didn't do either of those things. I slunk back into the crowd and quietly slipped into my 55-minute physics class, which seemed to pass like an eternity. When the final bell of the day rang, I hurried to the Falcon without going to my locker and quickly departed. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I especially didn't want to talk to Ernie. For 3 years, I had been building up Ernie on the athletic fields to the point that he was a demigod at St. Joe's and a household name throughout the county. Even national newspapers had been writing stories on him and speculating which of the 36 scholarships being dangled by some of the best schools in the country he would take. And he wouldn't have even gotten that far had I not dragged his ass through grammar school. Did he also have to be class valedictorian, the only accolade I had a chance to win? I did not immediately tell my mother of my latest slight when I got home from school. Not that she bothered to approach me. My mother had remained cool in the aftermath of my drinking incident. She had not reached the level of acceptance my father had, unwilling to admit I was a man capable of making decisions for myself. My mother had spent her life advocating for me, ensuring that I received the same opportunities as any other child. And her maternal instinct, finally honed from those years, would always be to protect me. But at this moment, I knew she was worried as to whether she could protect me from myself. I understood her worry, but I also couldn't help but be a little bitter. Once again, her steadfast faith in God's will and my destiny to live an extraordinary life had rung hollow. I waited until we were all seated at the dinner table, deliberately breaking my mother's rule forbidding conversations that could be disruptive to our digestion. As my mother served fried chicken, I said, "I have some news." My father placed a chicken breast on his plate and looked to me. My mother tossed the salad. "Oil and vinegar, okay?" She proceeded to pour the mixture without our input or acknowledging me. "Maddie," my father said, "Sam said he has some news." My mother stopped tossing the salad and looked at me, but before I could utter a word, her eyes went wide in anticipation. "Is it the class valedictorian? Oh, Sam, I knew you would get it. I knew it. I'm so proud of you." "I didn't get it," I said. My mother slowly set down the wooden utensils and slumped into her seat in silence. "What do you mean?" "I mean they chose Ernie," I said. We listened to the hum of the refrigerator and the tick of the clock in an awkward silence my father finally broke. "Well, that's quite an honor for Ernie, isn't it? We'll have to call the Cantwells and congratulate them. Won't we, Maddie?" But my mother did not answer. Her mouth was pinched tight and her brow furrowed. She turned her head to avoid crying in front of me. I stood and walked to her, placing my hand on her shoulder. "It's okay, Mom," I said. "No," my mother said, crying tears of anger. "It's not okay, Samuel." Then she did something I had not heard up to that day or since. She swore. "Damn it. It's not okay. Those members of the Board of Trustees are cowards. All of them are nothing but a bunch of cowards." Maddie, my dad said, let's not be ungracious. Why not? She seethed. Everybody else is. Ernie's had it rough, too, I said, trying to be sympathetic to the racism Ernie had endured. Inside, however, the pain was excruciating, and I wondered if I'd be able to face Ernie again without bitterness. You earned this, Samuel, my mother said. You earned this, and they are not going to take this away from you. Tomorrow morning, I'm going to make some calls and let them know they can't... No, I said, interrupting her. No calls, Mom. This is not right. It's not right. No calls, I repeated, with a firmness that gave both my parents pause. Maybe it isn't right, but it's the way it is, okay? It's the way it is, and the sooner we all realize this, the better it will be. We won't be getting our hopes up for things that are unreachable. I sat back down. Do you remember the time you said that the sooner I learned to accept the fact that I was different, the sooner I could learn to deal with it? I never said any such thing to you. To Dad, I said. When I didn't get accepted to OLM, and you went to that reporter friend of yours, and it was all over the news. Dad said it would have been better to just let me blend in, and you said that could never happen because I can't blend in, and the sooner I learned to accept it, the better. Samuel, that is not what... I've accepted it, Mom. I've accepted who I am, okay? I'm not a kid who's going to get picked to play kickball or to be the lead in the school play. I'm not going to be invited to parties or be chosen class valedictorian. I'm not. And I'm okay with that. It sounded convincing, though I wasn't okay with it. It hurt like hell, rejection. And the pain lingered like an open wound that, just as it started healing, was ripped open again. Well, I'm not, my mother said quietly. Well, it's not your life, I said, and again everything came to a sudden halt. It's mine, and I'm the one who has to live it. I'm the one who has to deal with it. Tears welled in my mother's eyes. I knew it hurt. Reality could be painful to acknowledge, but there came a point when we all realized we weren't going to walk on the moon, star in a Hollywood movie, or be president of the United States. We'd be who we were. And we could either come to grips with this fact and like the person we'd become, or live with regret and disappointment. My reality was that I was not going to live some extraordinary life, as my mother so fervently believed and prayed for. Life's a bitch, kid, and then you die. My mother turned as if to grab something from the counter, wiping at her eyes with a dish towel. My father gave me a subtle nod, not of approval, but of understanding. This was another of those rite of passage moments. Then we'll respect your wishes, Sam. Maddie, he said, calling her back to the table. Why don't we eat? And after dinner, we can call the Cantwells to congratulate Ernie. But that also wouldn't be necessary. As we washed and dried the dishes, the front doorbell rang, and when I went to answer it, I discovered Ernie and his parents standing on the porch. His mother carried a box with her, but none of them looked happy. Hey, Sam, Ernie said, sheepish. Hey, Ernie. My parents walked into the entry, and after an awkward greeting, the silence was palpable. My mother finally invited us all into the living room. She offered to make coffee or tea, but everyone declined. Ernie has something he'd like to say, Mr. Cantwell said. Ernie looked to me. I'm going to turn it down. What? The class valedictorian. I'm going to turn it down. Ernie, you can't do that, my father said. This is a great honor. It isn't right, Mrs. Cantwell said. Sam finished first in his class. This is his honor. He deserves it. I shook my head. They're not going to let me do it, I said. Let's face it. They don't want a kid with red eyes representing the whole school in front of the Archbishop and all the parents. If I can't do it, I'd just as soon it be Ernie. Well, I'm not doing it either then, Ernie said. Ernie, you should do it, my mother said, though I still detected the disappointment in her voice. They chose me because I'm black. What? I asked. They've never had a black valedictorian. I'd be the first. They think it would look good for the school, for recruiting people of color. People who can play sports, Mr. Cantwell said. In my self-pity, I had been too busy thinking of the reason why the school had not chosen me. I hadn't stopped to consider why they would have chosen Ernie over the other eight candidates. Ernie was certainly the best known among us, in large part thanks to my coverage of his exploits on the athletic fields, but his grade point average was nowhere near the top of the class. They told you that? I said. Of course not, he said. They can't come right out and say it, just like they can't come right out and say why they didn't choose you. I heard anger in his voice. They didn't have to tell us, Mr. Cantwell said. They roll Ernie out to talk to every black athlete who visits the school. And I have a friend who's a trustee on the board. He told me it wasn't expressed verbally, but the intimation was loud and clear. Discrimination is difficult because in its worst form, it is not overt. It is subtle. We feel the same as Ernie. The honor belongs to Samuel. If they won't honor him, Ernie will not stand in his place. After another prolonged silence, I said, "Who will they choose then?" Ernie shrugged. "I don't care who, because it won't matter. Once I turn it down, everyone is going to know what they tried to do. Kids were already talking about it at school, about the fact that you have the highest grades and they didn't choose you." "They were? Of course they were. If you don't get it, nobody's going to want to do it." "Are you sure you want to do this?" I said. "I mean, you could look at it like you'd be opening the door for other kids of color." "Those kids will open that door on their own, in the classroom," Mr. Cantwell said, "just as you have done." 8. Ernie's declination did cause a stir, but not enough of one, apparently, for anyone to ever apologize or ask me to be the valedictorian. In hindsight, the trustees couldn't very well have done that, not after passing me over. It would have been a tacit admission that they'd had ulterior motives for not choosing me in the first place, and, perhaps, an admission that their motives for choosing Ernie had also not been honorable. Despite this latest snub, my mother was far from finished pushing me to lead an extraordinary life. If anything, those moments only motivated her to push harder. Later that month, as I sat at my desk studying for finals, my mother entered my room with a load of folded laundry. I detected, however, that she had an ulterior motive and had timed this delivery for that reason. "Mrs. Cantwell called," she said, putting folded t-shirts in the third dresser drawer from the top. "Ernie's excited about the senior prom this Saturday." "Do you think I should start my English essay with a parable?" I asked. "You do know your prom is this Saturday?" "It would make Father Pete happy, but it might make me look like a brown noser." "Don't be disgusting, and stop avoiding the subject. Have you considered going?" my mother asked. "I think Ernie already has a date." "Samuel?" "People would talk, Mom. It's already an all-boys school." Humor did not pacify my mom when she got upset. "Fine, be that way," she said, though she didn't leave, and that was far from the end of the conversation. I put down my pen and took off my glasses, resting them on my homework. "I'm not avoiding it, Mom. Yes, I've considered going. In fact, I've asked 3 girls, and each has turned me down. Ernie also tried to set me up with one of Alicia's friends, but she chose to stay home rather than go with me." I had visions of me showing up at my date's house and having her father greet me at the door with some remark like, "My daughter does not date red-eyed sons of the devil." My mother used a rag to wipe an invisible dust mote atop my dresser and rearranged the knickknacks, including my priceless Willie Mays autographed baseball. "I think Mickey might be available Saturday night," she said. Good old Mickey. She was always there for me. But I couldn't do that to her. I couldn't ask her to be my senior prom date. She'd know I'd struck out with other girls, and she was the good, reliable replacement. Like that second pair of glasses stuffed in a drawer to serve as a backup if you lost the first pair. Maybe I'll hang out with her in the basement, I said. My mother tossed her dust rag at me. Samuel, you get one senior prom in your life. You are not going to spend it in the basement playing pinball. You're right. I'll go to a movie. You're going to the prom, and you're doubling with Ernie and his date, young man. Why do you always do this? I asked. What? Try to create memories for my son? Fit a square peg in a round hole, Mom. You're only a square peg if you allow yourself to be treated as one. Now you're going to the prom, and you're going with Mickey. Or so help me, I'll get out one of my old prom dresses, and you'll be taking me. If there was one thing I had learned about my mother, it was that she did not make idle threats. The image of me walking into a hotel ballroom with my mother was enough to get me out of my seat and moving to the telephone. Fine, I said, snatching the phone from the cradle. My mother followed and took the receiver from my hand. No way, young man. You do not call a young lady on the phone to ask her to the prom. You drive to her house and ask her proper. At that moment, I just wanted to get away, so I hurried down the stairs with my mother yelling something about flowers on the kitchen counter, which I ignored. I grabbed the keys off the hook and slammed the front door. 9. Mickey's mother invited me in with what I thought to be a wry smile, further convincing me this was a conspiracy. A moment later, Mickey bounded down the stairs dressed in jeans and a powder blue UCLA hooded sweatshirt. Hey, Hill, what's up? Joanna, her younger sister, and often her shadow, shuffled down the steps behind her. Hey, Hill, what's up? She mimicked. My paranoia now led me to suspect from their poorly disguised grins that Mickey and Joanna knew exactly what was up and were also a part of the conspiracy. You want to go get a yogurt? I asked. Frozen yogurt was new and all the rage at the moment, and a new shop had just opened on Broadway. Are you buying? Are you buying? Joanna asked. Yes, I'm buying. Then I'm eating. Then I'm eating. Mickey slipped on sandals and convinced Joanna that she could not go with us, as Joanna sometimes did, sitting in the back seat with her head between the two of us like a dog just excited to be out for a ride. We promised to bring her home a yogurt. I stormed out the door and down the front walk ahead of Mickey, not even bothering to open her car door for her. Inside the Falcon, she slid across the front seat, closer than normal, which only increased my irritation. Everything okay? Fine. Are we grumpy? Just tired. At the yogurt store, Mickey waited at one of the tables while I stood in a considerable line, growing more and more irritated by everyone and everything. After 20 minutes, I delivered Mickey a strawberry yogurt. Where's yours? I'm not hungry. Do you want to go to the prom with me or not? Mickey spiked the tiny plastic spoon in her yogurt. Is that the best you can ask me? I assume my mother has already asked you the proper way, I said, putting the last two words in quotes. As a matter of fact, she didn't. Come on, like you didn't know. I didn't know. And you know what? If I had, I would have told you not to bother and saved you the drive, jerk. Mickey stood and left the table, then came back to retrieve her yogurt. Thanks for the yogurt, asshole, she said and stormed off again. The two workers behind the counter and everyone standing in line were now staring at me, and not because of my red eyes. I'm not certain they could have distinguished them from my red face, but I was still irritated and in no mood for gawkers. What? Haven't you people seen anyone with red eyes before? I said, causing them to quickly turn away. With that, I stood and went outside. Mickey was leaning against the passenger door of the Falcon, eating her yogurt. I'm sorry, I said. I'm mad at my mother, and I'm taking it out on you. Why are you mad at your mother? Because she always does this. Does what? I was content to stay home. So was I. Well, say no, and we can both stay home. You haven't asked me yet. I asked in there. Doesn't count. Fine. Do you want to go to the prom with me?
Yes.
What? You just said... I said I was content to stay home. Now I want to go. You're just doing it to spite me and appease my mother. She put the yogurt on the roof of the Falcon and folded her arms. Have you ever known me to do anything to appease anyone? I hadn't. Mickey stood her ground. I'd give her that. Then why are you? Because I think it could be a lot of fun, that's why. Because it means I get to spend the night with my two best friends. It means I get to spend time with you. I felt about 2 feet tall. I'll pay for everything, I said. If you need a dress, you're not paying for my dress, Hill. She'd resumed eating her yogurt. Do you want to shut up now? I'm sorry about the way I asked you. You should be. I know. You're doing me a favor. She groaned. Stop saying that. It's not a favor, Hill. Why can't you get that through your thick head? You don't have to say that. Hello? Have you ever known me to say anything I didn't want to say? Again, I hadn't. No. Usually you say things I don't want you to say. She smiled and put the spoon in her mouth, being playful. And at that moment, I've heard people say things like being struck dumb, but it was as if I had never really seen Mickey before, seen how truly beautiful she was. Her head was tilted, and her hair, caressing her neck, had streaks of gold that glistened and made her eyes stand out, a vivid blue. What? She asked, wiping at her chin with the napkin. Do I have yogurt dripping down my face? No. I said, you okay? I nodded and briefly contemplated telling her what I had been thinking, but I knew Mickey would not take me seriously. She'd blow it off and say something sarcastic like, I should get my eyes checked again. Okay, I said. Saturday night then. I walked to the driver's side, opened the door, and slid in. Mickey had walked to the passenger door. I put the key in the ignition, but Mickey remained standing outside the car. I checked the door lock to make sure the knob was up. It was. I looked up at her. What's the matter? I'm waiting for you to open my door for me like a gentleman. It will be good practice for Saturday night. 10. The following Saturday, I stood in the marble foyer of Mickey's house in a burgundy tux with a ruffled shirt and burgundy bow tie. A photograph, much to my chagrin, remains in my mother's scrapbook for 1975.
Did you take a job as a waiter?
One of Mickey's brothers asked. My luck, they were home from college.
A job as a waiter?
Joanna laughed, holding on to the banister and swinging back and forth.
Is that Velvet Hill? I think we have drapes made of the same material, Mickey's other brother said.
We have drapes made of the same material,
Joanna repeated, laughing. Thankfully, Mickey's father had moved out of the house by this point. Joanna stopped swinging and yelled,
Hey, Mickey, Sam's here, and he has flowers.
She started up the stairs.
I'll get Mickey, Sam. My mom is putting tapes on her boobs.
I had no idea what that meant, and flushed a color to match my tuxedo. Mickey's brothers and I sat in the den with the television blaring. After the initial ribbing, we made small talk about the Giants and the 49ers. I felt like the room was 1,000 degrees. Finally, I heard the click of high heels on marble, stood, and almost dropped the corsage. I'd seen pictures of my friends at their proms. The girls wore long dresses that made bridesmaid dresses look good. Not Mickey. She wore a burgundy dress that seemed to defy gravity, held up by nothing more than 2 thin shoulder straps. It sank low enough to reveal a hint of cleavage, hugged her hips, and ended just above her knees. Her legs were free of nylons, her calves toned above white high heels. I couldn't tell you the fabric of the dress, but it looked like silk. I really didn't care. As eye-catching as I found the dress, Mickey's face stole my attention. She looked like something created by a great artist, with her hair curled and diamond earrings protruding from her lobes. "Close your mouth," she said. "You'll catch a fly." "Oh, Michaela," her mother said. "You'll catch a fly." Joanna rolled on the ground in hysterics. "You'll catch a fly." "This is for you," I said, holding out the corsage. "Aren't you going to pin it on?" Mickey asked. I studied the thin straps. "Here, Sam, I'll do it," Mickey's mother said, coming to my rescue and giving Mickey a reproachful look. The corsage in place, Mrs. Kenny instructed us to stand this way and that as she took pictures and promised to make an extra set, which my mother would date, label, and slide into the photo album right next to the photograph of me in my tuxedo. Mickey rested her hand on my arm to keep her balance on her high heels as we walked down the front steps to the Falcon. I opened the passenger door and waited until she gathered a matching shawl and slid across the seat. When I got in the driver's side, Mickey sat in her customary spot. "Everything okay?" she asked. "You were kind of quiet in there." This time, I did not hesitate to say it. "You look beautiful." I did not feel the least bit self-conscious saying it. I was stating a fact, like looking at a waterfall and calling it breathtaking. "Really, really beautiful." Mickey blushed, beaming. Then she leaned over and kissed me on the cheek. My mother's suggestion that I invite Mickey turned out to be a stroke of genius. We met Ernie and his date, Alicia, at a local restaurant, and dinner was not the awkward first date so many of my friends experienced on prom nights. The conversation flowed, and the four of us laughed as much that night as any other. I didn't think the night could get any better. Then it did. When Mickey and I walked into the hotel ballroom holding hands, a lot of heads turned, and while other couples stood or sat at tables looking bored, Mickey dragged me straight to the dance floor. She sparkled beneath the strobe lights and spinning silver ball. Her years of dance and gymnastics classes had given her the ability to move in a manner that was part burlesque, part Ginger Rogers. I did my best to keep up, but I was grateful for the slow songs, which allowed me to catch my breath and to feel Mickey close against me. This time, we didn't need to leave 6 inches for the Holy Spirit, as we did in grammar school. She rested her head on my chest, and I felt her breath on my neck and smelled the scent of her perfume. It sent shivers up my spine. Late in the evening, when the band took a break, Mickey and Alicia went to the bathroom, and Ernie and I ventured to the bar to get soft drinks. "Mickey's a good sport, huh?" Ernie said. "The best," I said. "You two look like you've been together forever." "I've known her forever." "So have I," Ernie said. "But we don't interact like that." I looked at Ernie and suddenly wondered if this had been a mistake. Mickey and I were as close as Ernie and me, though in a different way. There were things I would discuss only with each of them. If I screwed up, I'd lose Mickey. "Do you think it could be a mistake?" I asked. Before Ernie could respond, I saw Alicia hurrying toward us with a look of alarm. "I think you better get out there," she said. I ran from the ballroom. Mickey stood before Michael Lark, the linebacker I had beaten in the drinking contest the night I'd ended up passed out in my mother's fern. One of the spaghetti straps of Mickey's dress dangled loose, and she had a finger pointed in Lark's face, the other hand balled in a fist. A group of my classmates surrounded Lark, some trying to pull him away. "Don't you ever touch me," Mickey was saying. "What's going on?" I asked. "I was just playing around," Lark slurred. I could tell Mickey had slapped him. His right cheek was cherry red. "Did you touch her?" I asked. Another classmate stepped forward, looking anxious. "He's drunk, man. We're getting him out of here before he gets busted." Lark smiled at me. "Like, who hasn't touched her?" he said. And in that moment, I no longer saw Lark. I saw David Bateman. We all know it isn't the first time. Come on, Hell. You've gotten some of that, right?
Knock it off, Lark, I said.
Hey, man. You and I are drinking buddies.
Not tonight.
Come on, Hell. Everyone knows that girl has had more dicks between her legs than in a football huddle.
I lunged at Lark, but Ernie quickly stepped in to hold me back, which was a good thing, because Lark would have likely killed me. I turned and focused on Mickey, hearing Ernie behind me saying things to Lark like, uncool. Mickey's mascara had run, and her eyes were red from crying. That's all it took. I turned for Lark.
It's cool, Ernie said, putting a hand on my chest. He's drunk. They're getting him out.
It's not cool. I said it loud enough that everyone came to a standstill. I slapped Ernie's hand away and walked past him. Lark! Lark turned, looking at me through glassy eyes and giving me the drunkard's grin. Even though he was stooped over, I still looked up at him, and he outweighed me by a good 40 pounds. But I also knew he had a full ride to play football at Brown, and that I was 40 times smarter than him.
You need to apologize, I said.
He stumbled.
We're cool, man. I didn't mean nothing.
Not to me. To Mickey. Lark's brow furrowed.
Sam, Ernie started again. I cut him off, keeping my focus on Lark.
Stay out of it, Ernie. Lark looked to Ernie, then to me, his eyes registering confusion.
I apologized already.
Not to her, you didn't. He leaned forward, close enough that I could smell the acidic odor of alcohol on his breath. It reminded me of Sister Beatrice, and I had the same revulsion. I'd never been in a fight except for my jaunt around the schoolyard on David Bateman's back.
Last chance, I said.
Or what?
Or we're going to go at it right here.
Lark smiled.
I'll fucking kill you, Hell.
He said it without animosity, with a chuckle in his voice.
You'll have to kill me.
I replied in the same even tone. Because once we get started, I'm not stopping. Then we'll both get expelled and throw away our futures, and next year, the senior class can come by the McDonald's where you and I will be flipping burgers together instead of you playing football at Brown. Explain that to your mother and father. For a moment, Lark's face looked like he was attempting to solve a complex mathematical equation and failing miserably. Then he grinned, and I felt everyone in the room breathe a collective sigh of relief.
You're a red-eyed, crazy motherfucker, Hell, but I like you.
He stepped past me to where Mickey stood with Alicia and Ernie.
Hey, Mickey.
She considered him with scorn.
I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that to you or said those things. If Hell likes you, you must be okay.
Mickey wiped her cheeks, but did not respond. Lark looked at me and nodded. Then he left. 11. I retrieved Mickey's shawl and escorted her through the hotel lobby to the parking lot. She kept her head down, her shawl draped over her shoulders. I opened the passenger car door and helped her in, gathering her shawl for her so it wouldn't get caught in the door. As I walked to the driver's side, I took a moment to catch my breath. We were misfits, Mickey, me, and Ernie. For all his exploits, Ernie remained the black kid. For all my achievements in the classroom and on the newspaper staff, I was still the devil boy, or at least the kid with the red eyes. And Mickey was the girl with the reputation. We were something for other people to talk about and make fun of. I thought of all the times Mickey had stood up for me, all the times she'd been there for me. She had been having so much fun that night, happier than I might have ever seen her. I wasn't about to let Lark ruin her evening. When I slid in, Mickey remained pressed against the passenger door. "We have a problem," I said. Mickey raised her head to look at me, her makeup still smeared. I can't drive with you sitting way over there.
I'm sorry, she said.
You're sorry because Lark is a drunken moron? I'm sorry you had to go with me, if I embarrassed you. I had to go with you? Are you kidding me? I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for you going with me. Maybe that would have been better. I had never seen or heard Mickey defeated like this, never truly realized the depth of her pain. Her home life had not improved with her parents' divorce. Her mother drank most nights and either passed out or became belligerent, belittling Mickey. Her father had moved on, found himself a hot young girlfriend, and expressed little interest in being a father. It was a loveless home, and I wondered if that was why Mickey was promiscuous. If it wasn't about the sex at all, but about feeling loved, if only for a little while. "Did you see the heads turn when we walked in?" I asked. "I know why the heads turned." "Really? Was it because I look so great in this frilly shirt and burgundy tux? I look like a friggin' red-eyed waiter in the Las Vegas Denny's." Mickey grinned. "They turned because you look beautiful, Mickey. Because you are beautiful. And Lark just did what every guy in that room wanted to do. I felt like I was escorting a movie star. And I'll tell you something else. But I didn't. Because I didn't get the chance." Mickey had leaped across the seat and pressed her lips against mine. Unlike Donna Ashby's kiss, no tongue probed my mouth. Just the warmth of Mickey's lips. She pulled back and curled beside me. "I love you, Sam Hill," she said. And this time, I got the chance to reply. "I love you too, Michaela Kennedy," I said. And she did not even protest that I'd used her real name. 12. As our senior year wound down, Ernie was mulling scholarship offers from all over the United States. I was debating between a few colleges, trying to determine what my parents could afford. I had received a $2,000 journalism scholarship for a feature article I'd written about Ernie, and the organization that gave me the award held a luncheon to honor me. My mother and I drove to Monterey and sat at a table with the president of the association, a man named Howard Rice. My father couldn't attend because of work. Rice was a 1944 Stanford University graduate and prominent booster, and he seemed intrigued by what I had accomplished, probably because I had done so despite my condition. At the luncheon, Rice was seated beside my mother and said, "I hope your son is considering Stanford." Stanford was $14,000 per year in tuition and room and board, more than I felt fair to ask my parents even with my scholarship money and what I had saved working at the store. "He's considering several different choices," my mother said, diplomatically. "Sam," Mr. Rice said, turning to me, "I want you to apply. I'll have an application sent to you tomorrow, and I want you to put me down as a reference. I will write you a letter of recommendation." Mr. Rice was a man of his word. A week after the luncheon, an admissions packet arrived in the mail. I wasn't going to fill it out, but my mother insisted, saying, "We don't know God's will, Samuel. Have faith. Besides, it would be rude to Mr. Rice not to fill it out. He went to the trouble to send it, after all." More to appease my mother, and because Mr. Rice had gone to the effort, I filled out the application. I prepared my essay the night before the application deadline, writing about my life with ocular albinism. I mailed off the packet the following morning and promptly dismissed it. About that same time, I wrote an article on Ernie Cantwell's college recruiting experience for the final issue of the school paper. The Times liked the article so much, they ran it on the front page of the sports section. I was thrilled. As I sat reading my article in the journalism trailer, my editor from the Times called, "You're famous, Hill. The Associated Press picked up your article and ran it on their wire service. Your name is atop the article in hundreds of newspapers in dozens of cities." The following day, as Ernie tiled off after track practice and I waited in the locker room to drive him home, Coach Moran, who had become the athletic director, in addition to the varsity basketball coach, burst into the locker room looking like he might have a heart attack. "Cantwell, my office!" "Okay, coach, let me get dressed. Now!" Coach, let me put on my... Stanford is on the phone, Cantwell. Coach Christensen wants to talk to you about playing football at Stanford University next fall. Or do you want me to tell him you're too busy toweling off your ass? As Ernie sprinted past him, tucking a towel around his waist, Coach Moran spied me. You come too, hell. Me? Why me? Because you started this. He read that article you wrote, and he might have questions I can't answer. Coach Christensen only had one question, and it wasn't for me. He asked Ernie how he'd like to play football at Stanford University. Ernie committed on the phone. When he hung up, Coach Moran was wide-eyed and aghast. You committed? What about all those other schools waiting for an answer? What am I supposed to tell them? Tell them? I'm going to Stanford, Coach. It's close to home. My mother and father can watch me play. And my father wants me to major in business and computer science. 13. The Cantwells threw an impromptu barbecue that night in their backyard. I attended in a dual capacity, as Ernie's friend and as a journalist. The Times wanted the scoop on Ernie's commitment to Stanford, a local boy stays local kind of story. I interviewed Ernie's mother and father and his maternal grandparents. I also interviewed his coaches at St. Joe's. I spent much of the party calling in my story to an editor at the sports desk. By the time I had finished, everyone had eaten. But Mrs. Cantwell had saved me a plate with two hamburgers and potato salad. I took my plate outside to sit by the fire pit while everyone else went inside to eat cake and drink coffee. Ernie had to make phone calls to give the bad news to the other recruiters. As I sat by the fire, I sensed someone's approach. Mickey sat down beside me, the flames flickering shadows across her face. Great news about Ernie, huh? Yeah, great, I said, and blew at the smoke threatening to engulf me. We stared as the flames spit an assortment of colors. Mickey had decided to attend UC Davis near Sacramento. Her grades weren't great, but she had obtained a near-perfect score on the SAT. It also hadn't hurt her chances that I had helped her write her application essay. We chose the difficulties of growing up in an alcoholic household as her topic. Don't judge him, Sam, Mickey said. He didn't make up the rules. I know, I said. My mother would have called it God's will for Ernie to go to Stanford, but I couldn't help wondering why I had spent so many hours studying to achieve perfect grades. I'd made the same fatal mistake as when I was nominated for class valedictorian. I'd allowed myself to get my hopes up. Stanford hadn't responded to my application, but I wasn't going to make that mistake again. I'd applied to the University of California schools, which had negligible tuition for California residents and were a better fit for my family's budget. I had been accepted at UC Davis, as well as at Cal Berkeley and UCLA. They were all good schools, and if I went to Davis, I'd have Mickey to hang out with, and I could get home occasionally to visit my parents. I drove Mickey home after the Cantwell's barbecue and stayed to watch a late-night movie with her and Joanna. They both fell asleep on the couch. I carried Joanna up the stairs and put her to bed. When I pulled the covers up tight under her chin, Joanna awoke briefly, threw her arms around my neck, and pulled me close to kiss my cheek. I love you, Sam. It was the sweetest thing anyone had ever said to me, because I knew it was unconditional. Joanna was not my mother, or even my friend. She had no obligation to say those words to me, and she didn't want anything, except maybe a stable house and someone to love. I smiled down at her. I love you too, Jojo. When I started from the room, I found Mickey leaning against the door jamb, staring at me with an impish grin. We shut the door and stepped into the hall. You don't have to walk me to the front door, I whispered. Go to bed before you fall asleep on your feet. Aren't you going to tuck me in too? She asked, also keeping her voice soft. I smiled. I'd thought about it ever since the night of our senior prom, but I also didn't want to screw up our friendship, especially with Mickey leaving in the fall. If we both went to UC Davis, things might be different, and maybe I'd have the chance to be Mickey's boyfriend. But if I chose to go elsewhere, I didn't want to try to get through college and think about the boys she was dating.
You're going to be a great dad someday, Sam.
I don't know about that.
Don't know that you'll be great?
Don't know about being a dad, I said.
Why not? You had a great role model, and you have so much love to share.
Maybe. Maybe someday I'll adopt. Mickey stepped back, squinting at me.
Why would you say that?
You know why. I'd be worried my children would be like me, you know, have my eyes.
They should be so lucky, she said.
Lucky?
Yes. They made you the person you are, and I happen to believe you're a very good person, Sam Hill. And I know Joanna feels the same.
Then Mickey pushed away from the jam and gave me a warm hug that felt as sweet as Joanna's and made me think that maybe I could be a dad someday and Mickey a mother. Maybe they'd be our kids.
14.
By the time I arrived home, my parents had long since gone up to bed. My mother had left the kitchen light on for me, as was her habit. I heard the television in their room filtering down the darkened stairs, opened the fridge, and poured myself a glass of milk. As I did, I saw a white envelope on the tile counter addressed to me. The return address was in red ink. Office of Undergraduate Admissions, Stanford University. 24 hours earlier, I would have torn that envelope open like a presenter at the Academy Awards. But now I just held it, thinking the envelope was too thin to contain an admissions packet, and I was in no mood to be rejected once again. That envelope reminded me of the bright, sunny morning when my mother and I walked to the mailbox on our street and found the envelope from OLM. She'd been so excited, but I recall even then that I'd held back my enthusiasm. Maybe it was just a young kid fearful of attending school, or maybe I was thinking of the cruelty and the mistreatment of which my father had spoken. Whatever the reason, I'd had my doubts. I held the Stanford envelope up to the light, but could not see through it. Finally, I turned off the kitchen light and carried the envelope upstairs with me.
Sam?
My mother called out to me when I reached the top step. I could have taken off my shoes and crept up those stairs quiet as a burglar. I knew the location of every squeak in every board, and where to step to avoid it. Yet my mother would still call out that moment my foot touched the landing. I walked into their bedroom. The blue-gray glow of the television cast shadows across their bedspread and flickered on the wall behind it. My father lay propped on two pillows, watching a show. He had been feeling under the weather, more tired than normal, and had been going to bed early. My mother was sitting up, rosary beads in hand.
You got an envelope from Stanford? She said, with practiced calm.
I held it up. My father turned his head.
What did it say?
I shrugged. I haven't opened it yet. My father pushed himself to a seated position and clicked on the lamp mounted to the wall on his side of the bed. The light accentuated his gaunt features and the dark circles beneath his eyes.
You know, son, it's not the school that makes the student.
I didn't want to hear it, but I refrained from saying anything.
Open it, Sam, my mother said. Whatever it says, it's God's will.
And I really didn't want to hear that.
I opened the envelope and pulled out a single sheet of paper. This is to advise that your application has been accepted. I shrugged. It was like the build-up to a movie climax, then being let down. They got my application. I guess they don't decide on the non-football players for a while. I left the letter on the bed and headed for my room. I got as far as the doorway when my mother started yelling my name.
Sam! Sam!
I rushed back in.
What is it?
My mother sat crying.
You got in, Sam!
I what?
It says your application has been accepted. Accepted! Sam! You got in!
15. The morning of my graduation, my elation at having been accepted to Stanford and the realization that I would be rooming with Ernie had not subsided. I'd been walking on air ever since that night,
The news had even tempered my disappointment at having been passed over for valedictorian. My mother, of course, was convinced that it was all a part of God's will for me, that it was all a part of the extraordinary life God intended me to live. I stood at my dresser, futilely trying to use the mirror to knot a tie, when my mother's high heels clicked outside my bedroom door. My father wore a Windsor knot as tight and perfect as any tied by the King of England himself. My attempts had produced a lump that looked to be strangling me, and had caused the collars of my shirt to stick up like airplane wings. "Let me," my mother said, walking in and slapping at my hands. I tilted my chin so my mother could undo my abomination and deftly craft the knot. At 6 feet, I had surpassed her in height, but standing there on the day of my high school graduation, it seemed the mirror revealed much more than our discrepancy in height. My mother had aged. We had celebrated her 43rd birthday that year, and now, standing so close to her, I could see the depth of the crow's feet at the corners of her eyes, what she called her worry lines, and how her once unblemished skin now displayed the inevitable markings that only time delivers. I had never wanted to turn back the clock. Despite my friendships with Ernie and Mickey, my grade school years had not brought fond memories. I had been happy to leave David Bateman and Sister Beatrice behind. High school had been better, but for all my achievements, I could not ignore the fact that, but for Ernie, I was rarely invited to parties, no girl had invited me to her school prom, and but for Mickey, I would have missed mine. Yes, I'd achieved straight A's, but that was a little easier when you spent most nights, including weekends, studying. Still, I had not considered that my mother would someday grow old. Grandma O'Malley, who had come down for my graduation and waited downstairs in the living room, had once proclaimed, "Time is wicked. It comes and goes like a thief in the night, stealing our youth, our beauty, and our bodies." I had watched Grandma O'Malley, a proud and simple woman, shrink and wrinkle and turn white over the years. But we expect that of our grandparents, not our parents. For some reason, we think our parents will never grow old. Perhaps because when they do, we are forced to acknowledge that we will one day grow old, and we face our own mortality. The barber who cut my father's hair, and now cuts mine, said it more simply than Grandma O'Malley. "None of us is getting out of here alive." My mother pinched the knot and slid it up to my neck. As she raised her eyes, I saw that she had accomplished the task through tears. "There," she said, turning her head. I reached out and hugged her. The tears we shed that morning were our silent acknowledgement that while the years might not have been extraordinary, as she had so diligently prayed, they had been ours. Come the fall, I would be leaving for college, and my mother would lose her little boy, and I would lose the person who had always been there for me, my fiercest advocate since the day I had been born. "I love you, Mom." "I love you too," she said. Then she stepped back, gathering herself. "Enough. I'm going to get makeup all over your white shirt." "You don't need makeup, Mom." "I agree." My father stepped in from the hallway. He'd been feeling better, but still looked thin and tired. However, I knew nothing short of wild horses could keep him from attending my graduation. I don't know how long he'd been standing in the hall, or how much he'd observed and heard. My father knew the depth of my relationship to my mother, and he didn't begrudge us a moment of it. My relationship with him was different. He'd raised me to be a man, and he was proud of me. But to my mother, I suspect to all mothers, their little boys will always be their little boys, no matter how old those boys become. I retrieved my royal blue cap with the gold tassel and grabbed the hanger with my matching graduation gown. My mother had ironed the fabric until the pleats could cut paper. When I turned back, I watched my parents depart my room, my mother wiping at tears, my father's arm around her shoulders, consoling her. I remember being glad they would have each other for support when I left the following fall, and I realized how much I would miss them. 16.